Okay. About 25 years ago, our older daughter, who lives in the Twin Cities, asked me, "Do you know Loretta Frederick? She's actually an attorney who has devoted her life career to make life better for vulnerable women. She's particularly focused on law enforcement officials, treating women who have been abused in a civil, caring manner. She does this work all over the world." I guess that's why her daughter thought she was an important and famous person. Doing this work, she got to know Joe Morris extensively. Joe passed away about 6 years ago, and we have asked her to share some of Joe's perspectives on life as well as her own observations. Just stand here, okay?
And I would like to introduce Doug Nopar, who some of you may have seen at this fellowship meeting before, as he spoke to you all a year ago or something, right? Okay. And he's here as he worked very closely with Joe Morris on a lot of issues in the community before he passed away, and much closer than I did, although Joe and I shared similar experiences in the gender-based violence movement that we're going to be talking about today. So, because Doug knows a lot more about Joe than I do, he's my co-presenter. So feel free to ask any questions about Joe to him. I met Joe because both of us have chosen to do some of the work to end violence against women and other gender-based violence for a number of decades. Some of his Democratic policy work and political work. And this book, which if you haven't read it, you need to, is a really spectacular kind of summary of who Joe was and why he was who he was, as a very spectacular and very wonderful human being who did so much work in a lot of justice areas that it's really worth reading this, even if you only know a little thing about the guy. Doug, this book came out of Doug's unbelievable smart thinking in that he interviewed his friend for hours and hours before Joe passed away, once Joe knew he was going to be losing his battle with cancer in a year or something. Anyway, so he recorded all these hours of the interview with Joe, and then he and Jerome Christensen piled up to write this book. And so great guys wrote it about a great guy. So anyway, you can buy these locally. Everybody should have their own copy and pass it around to all their friends. I just want to, excuse me, I went to Boats and Bluegrass yesterday and I don't know what I got, but it was. I met with John and Carolyn to talk about this invitation to do this speech. They bought lunch for my partner and me. And when I met with them and he told me this principle that you're talking about today, I was very perplexed. And I couldn't figure out how this principle related to why I would be asked to come and talk about this. Because I have no more functional. Also thought that Joe would be as kind of wigged out as I was about the language of this. And so we had a long conversation, like a long conversation about what this principle meant to you all, at least his version of it and Carolyn's help with that. And I said I agree that democratic processes are generally the best way to resolve disputes among people who have conflicting values or doing things that conflict with each other. I think that Joe and I would disagree that everybody who takes a position should have the same rights of conscience of everybody else in the world, because Joe spent his whole life trying to change the world up against the wishes of a number of people who were doing arguably harmful things in society. For example, he would have said that the people on the planet who are doing their best to exploit or destroy the planet should be stopped from doing that. And that the difference between his conscience and beliefs around this and the people who are exploiting the earth, their conscience and set of values, that they shouldn't be equally viewed. And that he had the right to exert his beliefs over them and their actions and so forth. And the same with his gender-based violence work, and the same with his civil rights work in the early days of his organizing career. So that was kind of why we were like, how do we manage this conversation? But we decided that together, the four of us, that if you think about this principle, about right of conscience, as being restricted to your community, people with whom you have something major in common, where you have to decide how you're going to advance your goals and live your life and, you know, advance certain principles that you have in common, that would be the application of this principle under those limited conditions. And so I thought of this as being something that we could think about when we decide we want to make the world a better place in some fashion, and we're doing it with other people. Under those conditions, everybody, arguably, he would think, I think, and I'd be curious to say what you think about this, we need to value equally everybody in our movement and their thinking about how we should do our work. And that the democratic process should be employed in that, you know, decision making about where we do. And the cool thing about Joe was he was the most spectacular organizer that I've ever known when it comes to this, handing over the privilege that the organizer or the participant in the movement has to the people whose lives are most at stake on the issue. So when it comes to gender-based violence, people who are subject to gender-based violence, in the beginning of our movement, we were talking about women. But clearly that was a narrow vision of that, because there are many people for whom gender is the, and society's thinking about gender, is the origin of much pain in their lives, whether because they are in a same-sex relationship and people don't approve of it, or they have a trans child that can't get treatment, or whatever the deal is, you know, gender generally is an issue that he would have. So what do you think about Joe and his thinking about this?
Hello? Is that working?
Yeah.
Yeah. You should just keep going. You're doing great. She thought it was going to be kind of an aggressive crowd, so basically you're just here for security. I'll just add one comment. He had a really profound act of sense of conscience, but he never acted alone. You know, so he felt it was very, you could only be effective if you were acting with other people that shared your conscience and belief.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's, you know, it's a basic principle of getting anything done. You know, one person gets just so far. And there are many examples that I know in my life, having looked back on the decades I did this work and continued to learn about it. I made so many stupid mistakes when I was not thinking about how the world would look or life would be experienced if I was somebody who was not middle class, white, really privileged, in a very privileged place in the world, relatively speaking. For all of my, working at Legal Aid, think I know stuff about poor people because I represent them, you know, that is not the same thing as living the life that people live, that is the same, each one of us. So I'll just give you one example of this. Years and years ago, I was working in the 9th Judicial District, which is up by Brainerd and stuff, to help the whole legal system in several counties do a better job with domestic violence cases in the courts and the legal system. And one of the things that a prosecutor who was on this team up there thought of was, she said, we get these people coming in for protection orders, you know, when you want the court to issue an order saying the other person shouldn't beat you up anymore, or something, get out of the house, something like that. And the police were also supposed to be responding in a certain way to complaints of this sort. They're supposed to investigate and decide whether or not there should be an arrest and so forth. So one of these people said, we get these women coming in all the time, they apply for protection orders, and they write what happened. You know, you have to say on the paper what happened in order for the court to start thinking about whether to issue an order. So they were filling out these papers, and the women primarily would say, you know, and then he strangled me, and then he took a gun out and told me he's going to shoot me if I didn't do something or other, and, you know, these terrible, they're alleging these terrible felonies. And the people at the court say to these women, so did you call the cops? And the person would mostly say no, for all the reasons that you would know about why it is someone might not summon the police to your house, even under these conditions. And so the prosecutor at this big meeting said, I think we should have a district-wide policy that says that if a woman fills out one of these papers and they allege a felony, we should immediately call the police department so they should investigate this alleged felony. And so everybody in the room was like, yeah, that's a great idea. We got to catch these guys and get them into treatment and stop this violence, so this is what we need to do. And there were two formerly battered women on this committee, two out of 20 people. And they looked uncomfortable. And I said, would you like to tell the group what you think about this proposal? And they said, well, I'll just tell you, I never in a million years would have applied for a protection order if that was the policy and I knew it. And the other one said the same thing. And then, and one of them was a woman of color, Native woman. And they both spoke then to the many reasons why that would be a damper on your willingness to go to the court and ask for a civil order of the court, kind of like a divorce, saying you have to get out of the house to the abuser. So this is an example of how well-meaning, even smart, people with a lot of experience. In my case, I was considered like one of the top legal, you know, domestic violence people in the state. Did I see right away? Bad idea, kind of. But it was more important to have those two women there to say, whoa, can I just explain to you why that's a bad idea? And so these are the kinds of things that that I think Joe was so good at. Like he, when I first met him, it was in 83, and I was still working at Legal Services here in town. And I remember this so distinctly. I was in my office, and I got a note, a call from the entry to the office complex. Can you see somebody right now? There's a guy who wants to talk to you. And it was Joe. And he had just moved back to Winona from Boston, where he had been living. And he had worked with the people in Boston who created one of the first programs, like kind of treatment programs, psychoeducational programs, for men who had been abusing their partners, to teach them over a period of several weeks about the advantages of being in a more egalitarian relationship where you weren't terrifying your partner and thinking of your partner as being under your control and properly managed entirely by you. So we, not to mention all the physical violence and lethal violence. So he came and he said he was doing this, and I had heard of this program out there. I was like, wow, you helped develop that? And he said, yeah. And he said, I'm here because I moved back to town because my family's from here. And I would like to know if you are at the Women's Resource Center, which I was president or something of it, wanted to put together such a program for Winona. So there would be a place that the court could order someone to go if they were exhibiting these behaviors and gotten in trouble for it or something. And I said, well, I thought it was a good idea. I think we should ask around and see what. And the two of us ended up writing, with the help of a couple of other people now and then, this curriculum for a 24-week program to operate in Winona called Counseling for Abusive Men. You may have read about this in the paper over the years. It no longer exists because this community doesn't see fit to put together a program like that, so that if somebody's beating up their partner and presenting great harm to that person, and often children, very often children as well, there is no place for you to learn not to do that anymore in this town, which is shameful and extreme in my view. But anyway, editorializing. The point was, he could have come into town from Boston, gone to the court system, Hiawatha Valley Mental Health Center, anybody else, and said, I know how to do this thing. I want to set up a program here, and got it set up. But he did not do that. He came to the women's advocates in town to say, what do you think? Is that what's needed in Winona? And put the power in the hands of the people who this program was designed to, you know, assist. And he did that over and over, over and over, all of his life. And his conscience was guided by this principle that You have to look to the person who is most affected by what you're doing before you run off and try to do something you think will be good for society. And that's one piece of the democratic process, a bit of this principle, I think, that he would, I think, I'm curious about what you think about this, Doug, I think that he would think that the democratic process has some limitations because the people who have the biggest voice, the most privilege, the most capacity to express themselves, they're the ones that get the attention and they get the power to guide the decision making, right? So the democratic process, I think, to be useful in the social justice movement context, needs to account for the difference in the privilege in the room. You know what I mean? So what are you thinking about this?
You're way too intellectual for me.
Oh, sorry. I mean,
there's quite a few of Joe's friends in the room, so hopefully people will chime in a bit at the end. You know what? Joe devoted, you know, he was involved in so many different causes, but the cause of violence against women was really paramount. And so I often ask myself, and I asked him why. I often, so why was the cause of violence against women sort of paramount for him above everything else he did? And he said a couple things. One was he realized through his work in the civil rights movement that democracy wasn't working unless black people were fully involved in society. And he realized that eventually, that if women weren't fully involved, we didn't have a fully functioning democracy either. And that women were being held back from being involved by their partners and structures. And I know there are countless situations of women stepping forward and their husbands or partners said, oh no, we're not getting involved with that, you're not speaking up. So that was one piece, is the democracy piece. The other piece about personal conscience, so he was on the path to being a Catholic priest, okay? So that's a really heavily developed personal conscience in his family and in his upbringing. But he also allowed himself, starting in his 20s, to be held accountable by women that he met. And I think that challenged him and got him thinking a little bit. Profound sense of consciousness, of conscience, willing to be held accountable by people he was working with, and as he told me, as he was relating back to his time when he was in his 20s, you know, I was a real sexist back then. I mean, this guy did not start out as a pro-women gender rights advocate. And Joe was married in his early 20s. And at one point, he pushed his wife down on the bed. She was really ticked off, and he pushed her, and he controlled her. And I think his own person, and I didn't hear that till these interviews, okay? But I think that profoundly affected him. Conscience, accountability, as he learned from other women.
I asked John couldn't we have a conversation about this? And so I'd rather not just keep talking, I'd rather have a conversation about this. Okay, good. So who wants, does anybody?
Right,
Okay.
People have questions.
There are people that...
Thanks, Don. So I work with Joe Morse and my students on the Tough Guys, Beyond Tough Guys brochure. So he came to my professional communication class, and before the class he said, so Emily, what are we doing here? He wanted to know what the purpose was. And I said, well, I want you to talk about your career of being a voice, an advocate for social justice, and about this Beyond Tough Guys program. And he was delighted that one of the projects in my class was to have the students design a pamphlet for it, and then they presented those pamphlets to him, and then he chose the one that he thought was the best. I felt at that time, this was like maybe 15 years ago, I felt at that time that it was really important that my students see someone like Joe and work with him and see how that two-way street goes, you know, that it's got to be that teamwork, that sense of community. And then later, one of the memorable interactions...
I'm sorry, I keep forgetting her name.
Emily?
No, right here.
You. Leslie.
Leslie. Probably three people saved my life and my children's life. Women's Resource Center and all the advocates, Leslie and the Battered Women's Group I was in. This was 37 years ago. And I also knew Joe almost immediately upon arrival in town. And I also like to thank the Wiscoy community, which is pretty supportive. So I've always wanted to say that. I think I say it to Leslie once a year, but Greta, I don't see you very often. And Margaret Shaw Johnson, that was 10 years later, we were still fighting for our lives. And she stepped right in and read my ex-husband the Riot Act. So every time I see Margaret, I give her a hug and say, you know, you saved my children's and probably my life as well. So thank you very much. A lot of people don't know that part of me, but it was a